Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Masonic Effects, that place where we gather with some infrequency to talk about things that have a bearing on our craft. And not so much the story of life, and that's what Masonry is. It's a story about life and about art. The technical stuff of the craft, that's the craft. That's that part. We're not too controversial here. We don't declare with that usual muscularity the what sets us apart, but we look at what connects us. And yeah, this is the place where we do have that notion that we can examine some of the early premises of Masonry in good conscience, and should, because times are a-changing, and in order for us to stay relevant, well, we just can't be that that beautiful shell left on a beach of other millions of beautiful shells. We have to be able to let people know that within this seascape are some miraculous things. We found Masonic Effects. Not quite 100 years old yet. Not quite 100 years old, but we'll get there. You know? There. Well, listeners, that's the very first time in, 11 years, that our connection out there through Skype has been dropped. Apologize, of course, and it's time to get on with more interesting things. A shout out and thanks for all of you listeners from South Korea, Brazil. These are all places where there's some interesting things going on, I would say. Russia, of course, Philippines, and the United States, and Uganda, hello, and Austria, and China, and France, and the United Kingdom, and of course, Canada. It's a distinct pleasure to have you here, have you join us each and every week, and it suggests that we have something relevant to offer you. The commentary today, I think, is particularly useful. Everything in play all the time speaks to more of a sense of the relevance of Masonry in the 21st century. But as we're listening, as you're carrying on your work, I want to just ask you to be mindful of some principles within the order. I like to think of this as some of the metaphors that have come from jazz musicians over the years, that in fact within Masonry, I think there's a really interesting allegory. There's no wrong notes. The wrongness of Masonry, the friction, if I can put it that way, the wrongness, is when we make judgments. Our work is more the examination. Well, we can make those discriminant judgments moment by moment and hour by hour, but they're not the showstopper. They're not the point. And if you choose that, well, that's fine, but it tends to be in the vernacular an un-Masonic way of approaching our lives. So with that hope that you and I can do better tomorrow than we are today, well, let's plunge into this. If that's a little too sophomoric for us all on this day, well, this is the 8th of April of 2018. It's the 98th day of the year. So it only gives us 267 days to celebrate this this incredible year. We're closing in on solstice, 73 days to summer solstice. And I want you to be right-minded about that. That's if our ideas predate Christianity, the ideas of Christianity predate those demarcations, the births, the work, the morphing, the evolution of these ideas. We can be not afraid. We can explore and listen and examine those old ideas and see them for what they are. And we have a whole box full of those that information around us in the symbolism of Masonry. So we have some really interesting. I think we've settled back here. I don't see that I'm getting any signals that our line has been dropped at all. This is a bit of music to help us all focus. This, I think you'll like this. This is Vals de Niglos. This is, it is what it is. Check it out. Thank you. they're trying. They're trying. For me, they're better than barbershop quartet, but what do I know? This is Masonic Effects, and thank you for joining us here today. Everything in play all the time. This is the commentary I had in mind. And you can tell that I had, I'm always sort of mindful that, you know, our craft here, we're influenced by our experience. And some thinkers and more clever people than me might say that we're limited by our experience. And then just as I begin to contemplate that kind of thinking, I realized that, you know, it doesn't account for the dream state, for that going beyond, accepting the popular limits, accepting our own limits. Can we be anything that we want to be? No, I don't think so. But can we be content? Yeah, I think we can. Regardless of our station in life, yes. And some of that comes from experience, and some of that comes from a deep-rooted belief. But it is, I think, more achievable than the, I don't know, is it a false expectation that we implant that a person can aspire and to be anything that they want? Well, I may want to be the virtuoso at the keyboards, but I may not have the talent. I may want to be that first violinist, but I may not have the talent or the instrument. My voice may not carry to the high C. It doesn't mean I can't appreciate. If I'm meager of character, then the assumption would be anything that I can't have allows me to drop into a funk. Which I think is allowed to happen without challenge far too often. If we're able to understand our talents and abilities honestly and frankly, and we can deal with them, then we know more about ourselves than a lot of people do. Is that an advantage? Well, it depends how you look at it. It's an advantage for those who are seeking the truth, that blend of subjectivity and objectivity that keeps us in balance. We have, and that fluctuates day by day and hour by hour, and it fluctuates within the mind of Masons as well. We have things to do, but we're in a way not so prepared to have those, you know, those opportunities to sit and talk about the potential for the order. We would have a hard time brainstorming Freemasonry. Like, let's sit down and brainstorm. If we're generally talking about connections, when we're talking about brainstorming, connections with the outer world, perhaps thinking that we need to cast our nets a bit broader to ensure that those that are at a point in their life where they can be receptive to the potential of Masonry in their own way will know that we exist, and we'll create for them pathways. But when we say that, we know darn well we don't create the pathway for another person. We never did. The world around us has changed, and we struggle somewhat with that, particularly in this jurisdiction. We're still catching up with you old cultures, the listeners from the world where there are old cultures. We're here, and this is a new culture, and we're still emerging. And we look at the gravitas of your nations with amazement, with deep appreciation. And some are still in that battle-ready stage of fighting and defining for their beliefs and their way of life. Here, the struggle goes on in a different way. Still, nevertheless, a struggle. But it affects the, just as your cultures and your history affects masonry in your areas of the world, so does it here. However, the interesting part, the very interesting part is you're like schools of art. You're like Baroque, or you're like the Bauhaus, or you're like postmodernism, because we may not have that school, that type of philosophy where I am. But once I learn about what you're doing, once I learn that you have a cadre of people doing this odd impressionist work, you know, breaking the rules, going beyond convention, the cubist, then you unleash, you introduce the idea, as you would if you were introducing a corrected mathematic formula. And then the question, it's not so much a question, it's a matter of time. What do we do with that? What do we do with it? We may need to contemplate. We may be confused. We may need to develop other skills in order to be able to use the gifts that you bring. And remember, masonry, like the arts and sciences, is not a blanket. There's no uniformity. This is certainly not an authoritarian kind of an approach to the world. This is an asymmetrical process, even within ourselves. But around the world, the messages that are conveyed carry deeper meaning at different times. Progress happens in different times, even within the same neighborhood or culture or family. But it always, the comfort that we have is that it's like gravity. It's there. Progress is there. And would have as much chance as controlling progress as we do of controlling the weather. Oh, we influence it, but ask yourself, are we ever in control of these things or controlling our destiny? We can influence. We can, though, as Masons, live a good life. And anyway, enough. This is everything in play all the time. Hope this fits together. If we were a service club, our participation would acknowledge an obvious and open mandate. Yeah? If we were a religion, though we might be close to Buddhism, we would be a singular variant on faith. We commit charitable acts, but we fail the test for a charity. Freemasonry is a presence, not a singularity. It's an attitude. If we meet the test that cements true Freemasons, we are more controversial than any constitutionally based corporation, institute, or state. All aspects of being, of purpose, of agency, of faith are on the examination table of a lodge. We are the interlocutor who seeks out and appreciates this binding, imperfect, confident atmosphere in which we contemplate. No need for posturing or muscular statements. These are people tasked with self-control and silence. Tache. Oh. There is no politics in Freemasonry. There is a concrete impression of manners. As a gentleman understands, there are two topics that make us seem fools. Politics is one, religion is the other. We choose to not appear foolish. Nevertheless, our apprenticeship begins uniformly but progresses based on talent. As is the way in many orchestras, all entertaining, some more accomplished than others, some are brought together by desire and curiosity. If every musician is the best, what is the sound of that music? Masonry stretches the boundaries and teaches how to use tools, but leaves usage to the imagination and desire of the individual. This is how and why Freemasonry is reconfigured everywhere, every day. It endures as thought itself. Far be it from me to suggest it will never be popular, but always essential. And if Plato left us with a truism, it is this: a life unexamined is not worth living. What the hell was he thinking? Ron Carter, Shadow of Your Smile. It's still performing, I believe. Yeah. I think he must be, what, 81 now? So he's coming up to his 81st birthday. Just an icon of jazz and well respected. I have a poem. This is by a British poet from the what's referred to as the Romantic period. And you have to do a little bit of reading to appreciate what it is that's being spoken about when literature is being referred to as from the Romantic period. It's not the boyish version of it at all, but this was groundbreaking stuff, groundbreaking in the day. The piece that I'm going to read for you today is from Percy Shelley's Music When Soft Voices Die. It's not a very long poem, but it's one of his most famous. He's quite talented, although, you know, he doesn't come from the universally admired great poets. Great poem. This isn't one of the his epics, but see what you think. You know, a poet who elsewhere had little time for much of romanticism praised music. This is Shelley. It was being talked about by T.S. Eliot. Music, when soft voices die, vibrates in the memory. Odors, when sweet violets sicken, live within the sense they quicken. Rose leaves, when the rose is dead, are heaped on the beloved's bed. And so thy thoughts, when thou art gone, love itself shall slumber on. Seems to be talking about a goodbye. But not a goodbye. What do we remember when our days grow shorter and we seem to be, if we listen to some of the oldest fellows around us, you know, you realize the isolation of the one of us who outlives all his friends, all his friends. I don't think I want to outlive all my friends. I think that would be, but you want to live thinking that there was something quite interesting and worthwhile in the meantime. If, you know, we're going to eventually ask, is there a purpose? Did I get it right? What in the world did that mean? Anyway, this is a short little piece, Amado Mio. It's a standard, yeah. This is by a band. This is singer Storm Large. I think you like it. Live concert. Outdoors yet. 1997. Thank you. Well, we'll just have to press on somehow, gentlemen, listeners. Nice selection of my dude. I'm patting myself on the back for that one. This is we're plunging into the use of numbers in the craft. Do you mind if we just segue from that? Think about, you know, to help. Just think about the mathematics that infused the mind of Pythagoras, that excited him, and how many mathematicians there are out there that Isaac Newton, that, you know, Hawking, that saw the poetry, the philosophy in mathematics, the music. Music is essentially mathematics, and the wonder of it is what our minds do with it. We have these little blips and vibrations that we call sound, and we put them together, as we heard with this last piece. Our mind does something with it, and we park it in through folders or experiences. And we can expand those folders and expand those pleasure points to the extent that every music would give us pleasure. Now, just think of how beautiful that would be if every person we sat down with is sparkling and scintillating and interesting. That means we've mastered silence. We know how to listen to help a person feel important with us. And think about it, that we begin to explore more about our own nature by understanding the distinction between others and ourselves, not the similarities. The similarities we can find in anywhere. That's simple-minded. That's not for Masons. We want to be able to explore for our own nefarious purposes, the differences. How do you, where you are, approach notions of liberty and freedom and beauty and harmony? And what does it mean in your life? And how do you handle the burdens, the tasks that that are on us? And how do we handle the, you know, that separation, that how do we handle the cynicism that's so an easy climb? The to be able to overcome that that wretched, it's a cancer, is cynicism. And how do we control that? And how do we become aware and always mindful in our own lives, so that we can ensure that it doesn't get out of hand? It's not an inordinate influence. It's one of many, but it's not the predominant influence. But let's step across that gap with Pythagoras, with the great mathematicians that have been around. Who was the Greek mathematician? Oh, my. Before Pythagoras. There you go. H-E-R. The numbers 3, 5, and 7 appear to have a special significance in present-day ceremonies. This is really you can look at this as the technical stuff. If you're sitting down at the keyboard or you have the horn up to your lips, there's a mechanical precision that we need. We need to be able to master. We need to be able to appreciate. Or there's a magic when, the first musical group today were plunking away at the notes that were on the score, but they didn't have that, they didn't have that command of it as the last singer did of her craft. Similarly, when we're thinking about this, are we out ahead of it and waiting for what this reveals to us, or is this a burden and plotting? Isn't that an interesting observation even before we start? The numbers 3, 5, and 7, and I've heard these, I'm sure you have, over and over. It's like, oh. But they appear to have a special significance. And here's just going to be a reminder. This is like listening to your favorite. This is like listening to Pastor I. You've heard it before, but oh. Is that enough? Do you ever, is there enough Beethoven? Is there enough Brahms? Really? You might just hear something different the next time you hear that music. Don't be all judgy. The work at the end of the 18th century, we'll get into some Jersey stuff here. The work at the end of the 18th century, before the union of the two former Grand Lodges in 1813, showed a much more pronounced use of numbers. This is before the union, right? In the old lectures, it is particularly noticeable that 3 and 7 recur persistently. And to a lesser degree, they are joined by 5, 11, 15, and sometimes by 4 and 12. With a building with four sides, it is difficult to avoid the use of that number, and symbolic justification in the number of Gospels was quickly found. So there we have this is Christian context. Christian, just think of that as the vehicle for organized religion. And so oh my goodness, it's 4. So that's about the 4 Gospels. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, 12 was the number of both the tribes of Israel and the apostles. Oh, there it is. That's what it means. That's what it means. That's the what I'm familiar with. Not that I've studied any of this, but that's what I've been told. Oh dear. With a building. After the 12, a remainder are all odd numbers, and of these, 3 is the most persistent. At various times, there are, for example, 3 knocks, steps, lights, pillars or columns, staves on a ladder, faith, hope, and charity. Principal officers and the grand masters of old times, as well as 3 degrees. There are also many instances of the deliberate use of the three words together. Squares, levels, and perpendiculars. Sign, token, and word. Mature age, sound judgment, and strict morals. Hail, conceal, and never reveal. Secrecy, fidelity, and obedience, and many more. The number three dominates the craft, according to this writer. In one version of the old lectures that date about 1790s, there's one passage with a particularly strong reference to three. It refers to an obligation taken, my left hand supporting three, my right hand covering three. While it is described as consisting of three points and three penalties, the candidate was entrusted with three secrets and was given three charges and three duties. The number is mentioned on each occasion, and this constant use is not by accident. Another passage brings in seven in conjunction with the three, but this appears to be an attempt to relate three and seven and seems contrived. It does indicate that at that particular time in Masonic development, there was this extreme interest in certain numbers. And it was about the same time that particular numbers started to be associated with 3 degrees, and that the staircase developed into a symbolic symbol related to those same numbers. I'll give you a reference here. This is the author of A Defense of Masonry, as early as 1730, had something to say about 3, which he notes occurs so frequently in Pritchard's exposure of the time. Remember, Pritchard was, you know, the big scandal sheet of the day. He finds that the ancients, both Greek and Latins, professed a great veneration for the same number. And after quoting some instances, he goes on, whether this fancy owes its original to the number 3, because containing a beginning, middle, and end, it seems to signify all things in the world, or whether to the esteem the Pythagoreans and other philosophers had for it on account of their triad or trinity. Or lastly, to mention no more opinions, to its aptness to signify the power of all the gods who were divided into 3 classes, celestial, terrestrial, and infernal. I shall leave to be determined by others. The gods, as Virgil asserts, had a particular esteem for this number. The same author has something to say on the question of the number 7. I instantly recurred to the old Egyptians who held the number of 7 to be sacred. More especially, they believed that whilst their feast of 7 days lasted, the crocodiles lost their inbred cruelty. And Leo Afer, in his description of Africa, says that even in his time, the custom of feasting so many days and nights was still used for the happy overflowing of the Nile. The Greeks and Latins professed the same regard for that number, which might be proved by many examples. The overflowing of the Nile, remember, brought back the effluent that nurtured, brought back a nitrogen that nurtured the crops along the Nile. We have lots of symbols in Masonic lodges about that whole event, from the star in the east. But I digress. In this instance, the author seems to be calling the ancient mysteries in aid, but a number of early manuscripts refer to 7 as the number of perfection and suggest that this is taken from the Bible, as the creation from chaos to perfection is recorded as taking place over 6 specific periods followed by 1 of rest. The Dumfries number 4 manuscript catechism of about 1710, so we're really early here, refers to the Trinity as the justification for 3, in this case for 3 staves of a ladder. Throughout the 18th century, there is constant reference to the triangle with its three sides, and through this, the number three is being emblematic of the Trinity. There were even triangular buildings in honor of the Trinity. In this period, Masonry in England was not abandoned, had not abandoned its Christian principle of religion in favor of a non-sectarian view. One such triangular building is the Triangular Lodge at Ruston near Kettering, which was built by Sir Thomas Tresham about 1593-95. Everything is arranged in threes, and all measurements are exactly divisible by three. The building has three floors, three gables on each side that are separate devices in each of its three sides, arranged in threes. Just below the gables on each side are quotations from the Vulgate. Remember that early authorized version of the Bible?
Yeah.
Each containing 33 letters. There are, in addition, a number of figures of a pious nature used as decoration. It is often claimed that because James Anderson in his Constitutions included a note under concerning God and religion, that it is now thought more expedient only to oblige them in that religion in which all men agree, leaving their particular opinions to themselves. That Masonry was not based on the Christian faith from the early days of an organized Grand Lodge. So far as a study of the lectures, rituals, and procedures of the 18th century is concerned, those which have survived show that nothing could be further from the truth, for the whole is based on a Christian way of life. Anderson was a nonconformist minister, and the upholding of the Orthodox Protestant faith as practiced in the established Church of England was a matter of some importance in the days of George I. This could have been the reason for his wording. Now, on the other hand, at the time the constitutions were written, there had been a great movement toward Unitarianism, and many thinking Masons consider this may have influenced Anderson. Unitarianism proved to be something of a passing fashion, which probably accounts for the strictly orthodox religious approach found in later 18th century papers. In spite of this strong religious flavor in English practice, right up to the final de-Christianization of 1816, it has been found possible to admit into the English craft those of different religious beliefs as if Anderson's statement had that meaning. Now, we're going to have to rethink a lot of this because we know that Anderson's constitutions were a lot of spin. And we know that yet, even to this day, there are people that don't re-ask the questions. We repeat the questions of history. And we find that as we examine those questions, the answers that may not have come visible at the first reading, we may need to examine and re-examine. And we do. And each time we find new things. So is Masonry stuck or rigid or dogmatic? I would think it depends who you're talking to. If somebody has, is like anything else, if you're picking up a pamphlet and you're reading it and you're taking from it a literal translation of the meaning and intent, then it is that that's the way it is for you. If you're taking a metaphoric sense, if you go to see a movie and you look at it as a historic reference, or do you look at the story as a message telling us something about ourselves? This similarly, as you can imagine, with Masonry. So we want to wrap up the program for today. Thanks for being with us. I'm going to send us out of here, take us out of here with a mason, the work, a musician, who's a mason. And not that that his abilities somehow ooze over you and I, but acknowledgement of the obstacles that this man, and he has a guest playing with him, Ben Webster, an acknowledgement of the obstacles these men overcame. And as you hear, you know, their music is lively and beautiful. And everything about their background that we know suggests that they had reason to be bitter, cynical, and traumatized by the, and to express that in their actions. But they didn't. This is a song performed by Duke Ellington, of course, and Ben Webster. Ben Webster played with Duke Ellington's orchestra for the first time in 1935. So this is going back. This isn't from that period. This is a little later period where, from television. I want you to sit back and enjoy it. It is called All Too Soon. And thanks for tuning in. Thank you.
Maman,